Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Joining me today for this episode is Juliana. Say hello.
Hi everyone.
And today we're going to be talking about, it's going to be another book versus movie podcast.
Yes.
Mainly because I read the book and... And I thought, well, good book. Let's watch the movie as well. Juliana watched the movie with me. We watched a bit last night and a bit again this morning.
I think this was the second time I watched it.
Yeah. We're talking, of course, about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Actually, I have it when I was watching it, because for the last, what, 5 or 6 years, I've kept track of how many... what movies I'm watching and if I enjoyed them or not, like if they were good.
Well,
not
so much,
yeah, it was not a spreadsheet, it was just a TXT file. And then there's actually, what is it called? Letterboxd, which is it's like Goodreads, but for movies that you've watched. So I will add it there as well. So it was really fun to go back through, and I realised that like in 2014 or 2015, I watched 2001, A Space Odyssey, like not quite back-to-back, but I remember I watched it on an airplane, on like one of the small screens on an airplane, and then when I got home, I was like, oh, let's watch another version. So we got a DVD version, I remember. We got it from the video store.
Around the corner.
But it was just DVD, and we got that one, and we watched it. And now when we watched it on a Blu-ray version, and I tell you something, it is a lot more impressive. Some of those special effects shots, there's just so much more going on in some of them. Like when there's a few times when there's like these little windows on the side of the spaceships, and I was like, oh, you can see
the
people. You can see all the people in there, and there's acting going on. And beforehand I was like, wow, this is a long boring shot, there's nothing going on. And then when you look at the Blu-ray version on a bigger TV screen, you're like, oh, there's windows and people are watching that going on, and there's just a lot more life to some of those long slow shots. However, I'll get on to talking about the book in a minute, but just some thoughts on the movie. It needs, I think, it, again, I'd love to see the 70mm version on the IMAX screen that they're showing at the moment in various places.
They don't show it in Berlin.
Not in Berlin. We looked it up and we thought, okay, well, let's just watch this Blu-ray version instead, which is a good compromise.
Yeah.
Because the compromise is we can skip forward some parts of this. And I tell you something, 2001, there's some really fun parts in that, some really interesting stuff. But the part with the monkeys at the start, the man-apes, as they're called in the book, a moon watcher, which is the main man-ape character.
Oh, I didn't know he has a name.
Yeah, well, he's got a name in the book, and I think he's also credited, or like in the IMDb, he's credited as Moon Watcher, so he's like main ape guy.
Funny.
It's so long, and every time I watch 2001, I'm like, oh, right, this is like the 5 minutes at the start, you know, they hit, it's sort of like the monolith turns up, the monkeys hit things with bones and sticks, and they're like, and then it's sort of like, and now they throw the bone up into the air, it turns into a nuclear satellite or whatever it's meant to be, and then we move on, but it doesn't, it's not 5 minutes. And then after, and when we keep watching it, like about 15 minutes in, he does this thing where he throws something and a bone flips up into the air, and then here's the shot, and you know what, it doesn't happen then. There's like another 5 minutes after that of them getting into a fight. So it turns out it's not about using tools. It's not about using, like...
It's about fighting each other.
It's about weapons. And that's, of course, the key thing, is that when he throws the weapon up into the air, it turns into you can't know this just from looking at the movie, but it's turned into a nuclear weapon in space,
which was a big thing in the 1960s. I thought that was a spaceship.
It is a spaceship, but they're meant to be nuclear spaceships, like nuclear platforms, nuclear weapons platforms going on.
Okay.
And of course, that's the big thing, you know, with Kubrick in the 1960s. You got
Dr.
Strange.
What was this movie, like in relation book movie?
Here's the thing, they came out at the same time, or they were written at the same time, like Arthur C. Clarke. And again, this is just from my whatever pop knowledge about this.
Yeah.
But what happened was Arthur C. Clarke got together with Stanley Kubrick and they wrote the script, the shooting script, sort of like what happened. So it's a story by both of them.
Yeah.
And then Stanley Kubrick used the original script and changed it over time and made his movie. And Arthur C. Clarke had that original story idea in the script. It was based on a short story of Arthur C. Clarke's earlier called The Sentinel. But they, you know, they fleshed it out into a movie rather than just a short story. And then he fleshed it out into a book. And the book, and here's what I want to say about this, is that the book explains everything that Arthur C. Clarke thinks is happening in the movie.
Right, so it's more like direct explanation.
Yes,
so it's not
a
open.
Lot of it is a direct explanation. So, and this is how you know that those satellites that are orbiting are nuclear weapons platforms in space. And at the very last part of the book, like the very last page of the book, I listened to it as an audiobook this time, but I've read it before, so I always have it in the back of my mind when I'm watching it, is that it's a weapon, the monkey has a weapon, throws it up, and it turns into a nuclear platform.
Yeah.
Then at the end, when Dave comes back as the Star Child, he's, you know, he's his...
Giant baby.
A giant baby in space. In the book, the first thing he does is like, oh, well, first of all, I'm going to get rid of all these nuclear power weapons and stuff in space.
Yeah.
And so the first thing he does is he just... makes them all disappear. He reaches it, disappears all the nuclear weapons, and he's going, and I'm sure there's something else I can do, but I'm not quite sure what it should be, but I'm sure I'll think of something. And then the book ends.
So the baby has a conscience.
So it's that, it's, yeah, it's the Star Child. That is that is Dave. That is Dave accelerated through in the same way that when the monolith turns up with the apes and says hit things with sticks, and it accelerates their intellect forward to become, you know, from a step from animal into conscious humans.
Yeah.
And as we were talking about before, you're like, oh, that monkey is not acting so well. And I'm like, yeah, because we were just scrubbing through, we're just skipping through. It's like, oh no, that's Moonwatcher. He's become more human. That's why he's standing more upright than the other apes, which are all still low down on the ground.
Okay.
You know, there's that development, character development.
Yeah.
And then that's what happens at the end with Dave. He gets sucked into the, you know, into two different monoliths, one that sucks him in, and then he gets spat back out and comes out from the moon or whatever. Again, it's different in the book, different in the book.
Okay.
But yeah, so he comes out again and is the Star Child, and like I say, he is then accelerated into a being of pure energy and intellect.
Right.
And you know, which is the next step of human evolution upwards and stuff like that. So.
In my head, the movie was like what I remembered of it, like, or what I remember of it is, of course, the music, and then always just the bit in the middle with Hal.
Yeah.
Like, the beginning and the ending is always cropped out of my memory for some reason.
And that's the reason why, when we were watching, I was like, okay, don't need to... But you remember the stuff where they're going into the space station at the start, the trip to the moon?
The trip to the moon.
Yeah.
Because of this iconic round thing.
But, round spaceship, yeah.
But and I also forgot about digging up the moon monolith.
Yeah.
That was
so really, so this, really is what, is... this is what this movie is. It's kind of like four or five parts. You've got the monkeys at the start.
Yeah.
You've got the next chapter, which is the trip to the moon and digging up the monolith.
Yeah.
And it cuts out as soon as this message is sent to Jupiter. And we only find out at the end of the next chapter, which is the Beyond Jupiter, or whatever that section is called. And then we go to Infinity and Beyond.
Yes. So it's like 18 months later.
Yeah, yeah. And there's another step. And then once they reach Jupiter, then there's another one where he goes through the Stargate and becomes the Star Child. So there's those four sections. And yes, the most interesting one, or the one that's so iconic and the one that really stands the test of time, is that, you know, that third chapter when they're going to Jupiter.
Yeah.
And it's Frank and David versus Hal.
Hal,
you know, that section there is, I think, the most influential part of the movie.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And the parallels to Solaris are not to underestimate. Like, they are exactly the similar kind of amazing futuristic shots and camera usage and all this stuff.
Solaris, 1972.
Yeah.
And this was 1968. So, it's
later.
Around about the same time.
Yeah.
So, we've talked about Solaris. We've already done a book versus movie episode of Solaris, haven't we?
And the certainly the end bit, the like, act four, if you want to put it this way, reminded me very much of the scene when he's in the house and looks at the walls.
Yes.
Like... It could have been like directly the same thing. You have a view, we have a room, and then we observe it in painful detail.
Yeah. When was that? Yeah, that was 1972. Tarkovsky. Plot. Yeah, production and things like that. Yeah, when they just go, oh, and now we're gonna have a in part of the movie, we're just gonna show a picture.
Yes.
A Hunter's in the Snow from 1565.
Yes.
And yeah, so they just kind of pan around this picture inside the movie and like, okay, this is... But, you know, in 2001, we have this like psychedelic screensaver shot going
between the acts.
Yeah.
And but I still think that some of this camera work and set design is so impressive.
Okay. Let me just finish off my point before about the overall themes things, about the advancing of intellect, the monolith advancing intellect.
Yeah.
My reading of the movie in my head is that the second monolith, because it sends out a radio signal, the way that I've always read the middle of the movie is that Hal malfunctions because he's going through the same intellect acceleration as the humans are.
Of course.
And so, well, you say of course, but like...
But no, it makes sense.
Well, it would make sense. And I've always thought that, okay, on Earth, they used the monolith to accelerate on Earth, and then there was two more way stations. If humans are clever enough to get to the moon, mm-hmm. they can take the next step, and if they're good enough to get to Jupiter/Saturn, then they get to take the next step. So they have to show that they're capable of not just reaching the moon, but also, like, long-duration, peaceful, whatever kind of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I've always read it that they put Hal on board. Hal goes crazy, not just because he has, like, conflicting mission things, sort of, like, the mission is the most important thing, and in the same as all these things, sort of like human crew expendable, literally from Alien or Aliens, isn't it?
Yes.
Sort of like human crew expendable. So he's like, well, let's get rid of them, and I'm going to be the first one over here.
Yeah.
He's already on his way to being the next one, but then there's a battle against humans versus machines, or you know, biological
who's
brains.
Gonna versus,
who's
going
to get to the next step up?
Yeah,
because like Hal already kind of understands that because he's being accelerated to the next level. Whereas in the book. And actually in the movie, you realise that's not what's happening. That's just my own headcanon. In the book, it's very clear that...
Oh, is it?
Yeah, because Hal was made long before the moon, you know, because they found the thing on the moon in, what was it, like 1998 or something. And then 18 months later, it's 2001, and then they go on the space odyssey.
Yeah, and Hal is 1992.
Yeah, Hal was... His inception, or whatever they say, was in 1992 or 1994. I think it's different between the book and.
Oh, okay. In the movie, it just said 1992.
Yeah, I think in the book it's a little bit later. What does it say here? Yeah, the age of Hal. What does it say here? Oh no, I can't just. It was on the Wikipedia page that I looked at before. Yes, so. That's one thing that I read into it. But in the book, it's very clear that it's just mission parameters conflicting with each other. And it's that kind of like logical robot killer kind of thing where you say... I always love the idea of a robot killing like logical conflict or logical fallacy or just somebody not quite understanding, you know, what's... you know, the latest one I just thought was that Nike people like ripping off the Nike things. It's sort of like, I'm making a protest. It's sort of like, okay, you're making a protest. And you're like, so you're protesting somebody protesting. So you're protesting Nike for supporting someone who's protesting something.
Yes.
And you're like, that's not quite a robot killer logical leap, but like, it's one of those things where, okay, follow all this through.
Yeah.
Should this person be allowed to protest? Yes or no? Yes. Okay. So you think they're not allowed to protest.
But then you're protesting them.
So yeah, you're protesting someone who shouldn't be allowed to protest. Yeah, no, so
because
it's one
you
of those
are allowed to protest.
Yeah. Yeah. Though I think one of the original, I can't remember where I heard this term, but it was that great thing sort of like burning the American flag shouldn't be allowed because it's a symbol of freedom. And the freedom to do what? Well, the freedom, like, to, for example, burn American flags and it's that kind of thing. So I'm like, oh no, we can't allow freedoms because you're disrespecting the symbol of freedom. And you're like, okay, there is...
But then the freedom is...
Yes, exactly, that kind of thing that goes out. Anyway, these robot killers, it's sort of like, what is love, you know? And then it breaks the robot's brain because it can't understand what love is. Oh, you know, there's different kinds
of things. Yes, and the question of, okay, like the rules of robotics...
Yes.
Where you need it down to, okay... and here it's clearly mm-hmm. Hal feels threatened...
Yes.
And fears over his own life.
Yes, his own life.
And
yeah.
His own life gets more important because...
No, the mission. Because
the mission. Because
he's infallible.
Yeah, of course.
Because he is the most infallible thing. So it always comes down to human error if anything goes wrong. So the best way to stop human error happening is to get rid of the humans.
Of course.
And that he's just like, well, that's obviously the best way thing for the mission. It's not that he also is sort of like, he doesn't want to... It's not that he doesn't want to die because he wants to live. He doesn't want to die because then the mission might fail.
Yeah. And that's often like when you have robots, the mission is one of their most important things.
Yes.
Put into their brain, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
It's interesting to see, like, the book, is it Can you see the similarities?
Okay. So let's just talk about this. Okay, the book is an Arthur C. Clarke telling of the same story.
Yes.
With, again, all of the explanations of everything goes on. So there's this really great visual gag in the movie, which really sums up the difference between the book and the movie. It's this thing where is it Floyd? What's the character's name? Someone, let me have a look at it.
The doctor.
Yeah, no, the guy at the start is. Haywood Floyd, who's the guy going on the trip to the moon, who's oh, we're really glad to see you here, Doctor. You know, it's always sort of like Doctor Haywood Floyd.
I'm also not sure, like, because it comes across that he's like some intelligence person.
Well, he's in charge of the American astronaut, international thing. Actually, let me quickly have a look here. So, Haywood Floyd, he's one of the he's on the mission to track the source of the alien. The alien artifact or something. Oh, it doesn't actually say what his title is, but you know, he's the head of whatever the astronomical thing is for the Americans or something like that. Anyway, he goes and sits in the toilet, and there's this massive long list of rules saying, please read this before use, and he kind of looks at it, scratches his head, and then it just cuts away, and you're like, the zero gravity toilet, and you're just like, oh, that's really funny. In the moment, it's one of the few jokes in the movie. There are a few moments of levity in the movie, but that's one of the few, like, outright moments of, like, comedy.
And it's very, it's like visual comedy. Yeah. But you can't really read what it says there, but
that's
it's like,
the whole point. It's sort of like,
it begins at the top.
Yeah.
The shot begins at the top, and then it reveals, like, it goes down to 10 points with big
12 paragraphs of things of how to use the zero gravity toilet.
Yeah.
In the book, you get all 12 paragraphs and how it works.
Okay.
In the way it works in the book, I think you go into a unit and it's a little centrifuge. You get in there and you wait 30 seconds and it spins up and you're spinning around a center of gravity or something that, and so then when you poop or pee it forces down and then it flushes and then you stop and then you've got to leave it 45 seconds to stop spinning and then it goes back to zero. I think anyway, so it's that kind of thing. In the book it kind of over explains all the stuff that's in the movie, talking about the pods and talking about the different things, and he goes from here to there. And in the book it's kind of a bit boring. I mean, I'm not saying that the movie is fantastically exciting.
Yeah.
But what you get in the movie is people just living their lives in this way.
Yeah.
For example, at the end there, when he goes in to start taking the circuits out of Hal, he comes in and he goes into that room and he picks up just two things in his hand. And you're like, oh, what are those two things in his hand? And they're the two tools, because he already knows what he's going to do, but we don't know what he's going to do. So then he goes over and he uses one as a key and he opens this key thing and he opens that thing and then he pushes the two things down and then the panel comes along and then he goes in and he starts using that space screwdriver to open the space nuts and to open up the space memory of Hal. And it's just it's just fantastical touches, which makes me think and I was saying to you before, it feels so much like a documentary of like, if somebody is going to disable Hal, how would it work? Okay, putting aside some of the weird gravity stuff, but again, the gravity, all the little gravity moments that they have,
how
the gravity works and all that kind of stuff is so much fun. But all the time, every single time I watch it, I'm thinking, why aren't I bored looking at these special effects shots? Because they're so slow.
Yeah.
Everything is so slow. But all the time, I'm like, especially on this Blu-ray version, I'm just noticing like 1,000 new details into it. And this is what Stanley Kubrick is putting into it, and it's so subtle because he's let the set design and the spaceship design and all these different and the space suit design and all the different things that you see there. All of that is built in to the, like, into how the technology works. And you just see David Bowman's face when he's, like, talking to Hal and trying to keep as flat a face as possible. And because we already know that he's already got his suspicions about Hal, you can just see it's, like, anti-acting.
Yeah.
Like, in a modern movie, you would see if someone has suspicions about somebody, you would see it on their face. They'd be like, you always see it in TV movies where someone has to act innocent, but they can't act innocent because they also have to telegraph that they're not just acting innocent, they're actually guilty.
They have to show the audience that they...
Yeah, they have to show them that they have suspicions. So when you have a conversation...
So they have to act while being innocent, that they also...
Yeah, but then it's just a convention with us as movie maker things, knowing that the investigator won't notice how suspicious they're acting. Mm. But But, you know, we know that, you know, it's just a signal to us on the viewer. If you see someone acting as though they're trying not to act suspicious, where they actually look really suspicious, we know that other people on screen aren't going to notice it. It's a signal to us as a viewer.
Yes.
Whereas in 2001, everything is so, like, straightforward from, especially David and Frank as well. You know that they yeah. both understand that something weird is going on here and yeah. they don't trust him. And that they're like, there's an issue with my radio in the pod. Can you come and help me sort this out for me? And they go down and do it. But you just already know that, like, oh man, both of these have been thinking this for the entire movie.
Yeah.
Both of them have been uncomfortable with Hal for the entire movie.
Yeah.
And the both of them are really uncomfortable about the mission for the entire mission because they don't know what's going on there.
Yeah.
You know, the three people who have been trained separately.
They arrived already.
Yes, already. Those people know what's happening.
Yes.
Although in the movie that it's not clear that they do because they actually say when you get the Hayward Floyd commentary at the very end when he turns off Hal and then they say, good evening, gentlemen, or hello, gentlemen, whatever like that. So, that's a difference. So what I really enjoy about the movie is that documentary feel. Like, okay, what would it be like if you have, like, 1960 technology, like, broadcast, like, shot for, like, projected into the future up to 2001, plus an unlimited space budget, but then the Cold War is still going on, and, you know, you can see that kind of competition. But then there's the hotel on the moon. Is it the Hilton, the Space Hilton or something?
But it's just a terminal thing.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that, they say, are you going up or are you going down? It's sort of like, if you're going up to the moon, you go this way. It's like a way station along the way.
Yeah.
But just imagine unlimited space budget, Cold War still going on. What could the future look like in that way? The Discovery is heading off this way. You know, the different Pan Am jets and things going up to the moon. Yeah. And all of those bits, it's just sort of like, I don't know. It's one of those things that half of my brain is going, this is so boring. And the other half of my brain is going, but it's so interesting. And it's one of those things that I don't understand. Like, I mean, the appeal of the movie. People say it's like one of the greatest movies of the 20th century. It's certainly one of the most influential movies.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's really boring.
It is. A lot of it is like, especially in comparison to a modern movie making thing, where it goes up really quick after each other, after one shot. What I really like about this one is the clean and direct shots.
Yes.
And the how they just let one shot speak for itself.
Yes.
So they don't make anything tell the story, but just the shot itself.
No, you have to piece together the story.
You have to do some work. And what I really like is that the way that they use camera and music and other noises, this together creates another level of the drama and the movie.
Yeah. There's so many cool tricks. I mean, not tricks, let's call them techniques, but for example, as soon as someone goes into a spacesuit, the cameras go handheld and you can hear their breathing and it's a bit claustrophobic and things. So
you feel really uncomfortable.
I really enjoy that.
And also when there's these, in the middle, there's this Lux Aeterna music where the choir is singing in this very hard to this kind of music. It's very like you have many layers of tones over each other, and it's not easy to listen to. Very your whole body tenses up a bit listening to this music, and the usage of how the music influences you. Just listen to this is like,
well, I'm not sure they can hear it because it's just coming through my speakers.
It's lots of semitones next to each other and stuff with the recording.
Yeah, it was my fault. I wanted to press pause with the music, and I pressed pause with the recording. Carry on.
How much did it...
No, literally last sentence. Okay. It creates...
It creates an uncomfortable feeling. Yeah. And the other music, which is the Danube, like...
Those are the two main themes.
These are, like, this and... Yeah, these are the two main musics in the middle that go backs and forwards. And even if you see almost exactly the same scenes...
Yeah.
When they play a different music, the scene feels totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially when they do like the waltz, and then they have the spaceships, and then they move along with each other, and it feels very like a dance. It's very like swingy.
No, the use of music, I think, is so interesting because it's so unique. This is a silent movie. This might as well be a silent movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I mean, there is dialogue in the middle. But it's done in such a way where you're just on your own here.
Yeah.
and you got some titles, but again, the music isn't telling you how to feel, because the music is, it's the same, like, they use the same piece of music like four times.
Yes, they do.
So, and you're meant to be thinking, and you're meant to be feeling different things. Now, bring this back to the book.
Yeah.
Again, the fun thing about the book, or what interesting things about the book, it doesn't just explain, like, what's happening. It doesn't just, like, lay out what's happening in the movie, but then explaining, oh, and the technology behind this is this, and the technology behind this is this.
Yeah.
It's putting the homework in the foreground in the book, in the same way that the movie is putting the homework into, like, the middle ground. You know, like, there's something going on, but while you're watching what's going on, you're also watching all the technology and seeing how it all works and that kind of thing. Like I say, about just, like, the different different screwdrivers that they have on the ship.
The
buttons that they keep pressing as well. Why he keeps pressing that button? Like, and in the book, it's sort of like, oh, yes, and he adjusted the attitude jets and did all of this, and then he was there and that kind of stuff. Whereas it's kind of, in the movie, it's not like, let me tell you about the technology, and now let's carry on with the story, and now let's have a look at this technology, and now let's carry on with this character, and now
music,
let's go like
the technology just gets used.
In the movie, the technology is just like, we're watching it, we're seeing it.
Yeah.
We don't need to know the names of all the different screwdrivers. We don't need to know the scientific principles behind them all. So the book, in a way, it's interesting that, like, it's all explained, and a lot more of the character motivations are explained, and a lot of other things are explained, because you're getting their internal monologue.
Yeah.
Whereas the movie, and I totally understand why Arthur C. Clarke was like, people aren't understanding the movie, I'm going to have to release it, you know, the book's going to have to contain all of this. And it
does. So it's kind of like a manual for the movie.
It is a manual. It's sort of like, watch 2001 A Space Odyssey, and if there's something that you don't understand about it, read the book, and it will explain it. It will explain it. However, one thing I like about the movie is that all of the technology and all the space technology isn't explained to us, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's a centrifuge, and you're just like, oh, so when they're in the centrifuge, they have gravity. Like, there's a few things that spin, and otherwise they have to use the foot pads. And in the movie, they, you know, that's not that, you know, in the movie that's clear. In the book, it's kind of explained. But I really like the fact that anywhere that you are in the ship, you know that you're in a different position, a place in the Discovery, in the ship, because it starts off going like this, and then it cuts to this, and at that point you're like, oh, we're in a different part of the ship, and then it goes again, and then you get, and you're like, all right, we're with Frank outside the spaceship. Anyway, bringing it back to the music, the soundtrack is in the book.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh.
And what happens is that with one section is that we're after the crew is all killed and stuff like that,
terminated.
And you're just terminated, and you're just left with David.
Yeah.
David Bowman. It's sort of like, and then he was by himself for the rest of the trip to Saturn.
Mm.
In the movie, Jupiter; in the book, Saturn. Whatever. So he goes off towards Saturn, and he's like, oh, and then he started just, you know, all he had, he didn't have anyone company, so, and he turned off the spaceship, so the ship was being controlled from back on Earth and stuff like that, so he can't have conversations. So he started listening to music from the massive music collection that they have there. He's sort of like, and he went back through, you know, he started off with this music, and then he went to that music, and he really enjoyed this classical music, and then he's like, and then he started listening to Lux Aeterna, and he was like, and he just couldn't deal with it, because it was so much, like, in his face, like, it was so much a piece of music about loneliness and oppression and all that kind of stuff. And then he listened to this, and then he goes, and then in the end he just settled for
Johann Strauss.
No, not Johann Strauss. No, he was like, and he went back through Strauss, and he went back through Beethoven, and he ended up in Bach, and then he was like, I'm just gonna listen to Bach from now on. Yeah. So it was sort of like, okay.
Because I don't remember, I don't think Bach is actually...
No, he's not in this, but it's funny that in the movie, it's funny that the book was written, obviously, after the movie soundtrack was put in place, and it was so clear what kind of music it is, that even in the book, he references the music in the movie and said, when David Bowman was listening to this, this is what he was thinking about. So it's fun that these moments are in the book, like the toilet is explained and the music is explained, but again, it always feels like a little bit too... over-explained.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
Well, if you see the book really as a manual to the movie, it works.
It can work. And that's the difference between it. It's like it I know it wasn't written as a novelization. I mean, it was like the story was there, and it's not like Arthur C. Clarke wrote the novelization of the movie, because it was his movie, like, you know.
Yeah. In the the screenplay is the basis of it all.
Yeah. The early screenplays are the basis of it all. But like I say, Arthur C. Clarke then takes it and overexplains it. Now, the book is a lot more interesting in some ways, that because it tells a bit more about Hal, and it gets into more about what Hal's going on. And there's a lot more levity in the book. Like, the characters are a bit more like, oh, I'll do this. And I'll do that, you know. And yeah. in the movie, there's a few moments where, like, when was it Hayward Lloyd talks to his daughter, and it's sort of like, "What do you want?" I like a telephone. It's like, we've got telephones everywhere. And they're like, "What else would you want? A bush baby?" Like, what's a bush baby?
I have no idea what a bush baby is.
It's like a little monkey, isn't it?
First, I thought, okay, maybe it's a racist 1960s like, oh,
no,
this
come
is
look,
just
come
a black
look
baby.
Look, this is a bush baby.
Oh, I didn't know this has a
yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I just think, again, that kind of stuff will not be there by accident. So why does you want a bush baby? It's sort of like another, you know, it's like another primate link between,
yeah.
you know, children and the monkeys and the primates.
It's
got big eyes
yeah.
and stuff like that. So I'm sure there's links in there. And apparently in there's some extra footage that was filmed with him on the spaceship trying to find a place to, or no, on the moon, trying to find a bush baby on the moon. Because I'm guessing then maybe because bush babies are like used on the moon for something or something like that.
Pets.
Like, why did his daughter to ask for him to bring a bush baby
yeah.
back from the moon? So maybe
yeah.
moon bush babies are just a thing. I don't
know. Thing.
Anyway, that's all in the extra footage, which doesn't exist anymore or has never been seen or whatever like
okay.
that.
Okay,
so,
but they filmed it.
It's yes, a lot more had been filmed. Like, you just imagine a movie like this. How much more would Stanley Kubrick film that wouldn't be in this? Like, the original movie was like 4 hours long or something.
Whoa,
and I don't know how long
that's
it was.
Quite an edit.
So how long does it say here? I don't see on the Wikipedia page
and
the
it has
running
an intermission.
Time. Yes, and there's an intermission there, and it just stops, and you're like, okay, I'm not sure if... I don't remember the intermission, but it seems to go on quite a long time.
I think
anyway,
I remember
we did
the
skip forward. Again, I don't mind admitting, I will skip forward over
yeah.
some sections. Like, again,
I
need literally a minute of the apes, and then I'm like, I'm done with the apes.
Yeah.
The ape men at the start. Whereas the book, that was actually a really interesting part because the thought processes of what's going
yeah, well,
on inside
you, you can't get the thought processes
in the movie.
In the movie.
Well,
how would you get it? Like, let them,
acting.
Like... Yes, but there is nothing really to act on.
There is. I mean, the acting in the movie is pretty good. Like, the ape men are pretty good. Like, they do it. But a lot
yeah.
of it is just like...
Yeah, exactly.
And you're just like, oh, fuck. And in the book, you don't have to do that. So I actually really enjoyed the Moonwatcher part in the book.
In the book, they do have thoughts.
Yes, well, again, they're kind of like muddled thoughts. But
okay.
It says here, Moonwatcher, a man-ape who lived in dry equatorial Africa about 3 million years ago. He, his tribe, and his species are faced with extinction. But for the intervention of the monolith, which imbued him and his fellows with the beginnings of higher intelligence, evolution then took its course. So I really like this kind of directed evolution, just saying, it's like Uplift. You know, we talked about this in
yeah.
lots of books before.
Yeah.
Like, there's a non-intelligent, non-sentient species of alien. Let's just give them a bit of nudge in the right direction.
Like the intelligent people. So
and
like,
I really
yeah.
like it in the book where it's sort of like, oh yeah, and some people start, like some of the ape men started hitting things with sticks and others started trying to throw things and others tried like turning things in this way and other, and it sort of talks through a lot of the stuff that's going on there.
Yeah.
So that's more interesting. And then all at the end, the other bit which I'll skip through is the psychedelic Stargate bit, which is sort of like...
But you, like, I totally imagine like sitting in the cinema in the 1968.
Yeah.
And seeing this.
Yeah.
Whoa, you would have been like mind blown.
Taking some LSD and
yeah,
then sitting there watching
like,
that. Yeah,
yeah. I would totally think
but
that.
But now it's literally
of
a
course.
Mixture of Windows screensavers and the, you know, the Apple TV, you know, with the bit
yeah.
of flying over
yeah.
different landscapes. I'm just like,
and
all right.
Putting them in different colours.
Yeah, and for different freeze frames. Now that feels so dated and so just not interesting to me.
Yeah.
And it's music that we've already heard 3 times before.
Yes.
So the music isn't grabbing me and that kind of stuff. So yeah, we fast-forwarded through that bit. And to be honest, fast-forwarding through it...
It's fine.
It's the same experience,
but I
just
think
quicker.
That is definitely something that if you think back to the 1960s...
Yes, I totally agree with you.
This would, like, blow your mind.
Whereas in the book, that whole thing about him... Once Hal dies, that section of the book, so after he kills Hal...
Yeah.
And then goes through the Stargate. In the book, he goes down to the surface of Iapetus, which is a moon of Saturn.
Yeah.
And there's a monolith, and he tries to land on it, or
yeah.
tries... But it kind of turns inside out, and he's like, oh my God, it's full of stars, which is actually a line from the second movie.
Oh.
2010.
There's another movie?
Yeah, there's 2010, A Space Odyssey. Maybe we'll do the book. There's actually four books.
Yeah, I know this is like this thing with Arthur C. Clarke. Like, isn't that where other people help him write
it? No. These were all written earlier on, yeah.
Okay.
But there's a few, there were some later Arthur C. Clarke ones, which were like, you know, story idea outlines that he never got to and other people finished them off.
Like,
yeah,
like this Metro 2043 books.
Yeah.
Where like...
It's a series.
And lots of people contribute.
James Patterson is that one that we were talking about before, yeah.
But it's like Arthur C. Clarke just...
It's just him, and in 3001, the final Odyssey... Guess what happens? Frank Poole comes back.
Oh,
you know how he's let off from the thing like that. They find his body out in space, and because he was frozen a thousand years ago, he suffocates and frozen, and they actually manage to revive him.
Because in 2001, of course, you can do.
There's all that kind of stuff. So then it's something else happening in 3001 with other intelligences turning up.
Okay,
and it came out in the 90s. That book came out, although it's got the same ending as Independence Day. They upload a virus into the monolith.
Oh.
And he's like,
does it have a USB?
He uses a power book, a MacBook or whatever it is, to upload a virus into the... it's quite funny because at the time, Arthur's... Let me actually see this. I think I remember reading that. And
have you read all of these books?
Yeah, of course I've read all of them back in the day.
Oh, of course.
Actually, let me quickly have a look. 2001 A Space Odyssey. I'm sure there's a... Odyssey, followed by Odyssey 2, and then 2000, I think then it was followed by 2061 Odyssey 3, and then followed by 3001 A Space Odyssey. Yeah.
You have read The Odyssey, right? You have read Homer.
But not for a long time. And again, it's the same thing that happens in... the Odyssey is that people only ever remember the big bits. Not the big bit, like the most cinematic bits, where Odysseus is telling the story about what's happened with him and his men going there, and they forget all the stuff at the start, and there's all this stuff at the end as well, and people only remember, oh, there's a bit with the Cyclops and the bit with the sirens. The sirens is like 4 lines long or 8
really?
Lines long. Yeah,
okay.
But those are the moments that always stick out in people's minds stuff like that.
Well,
so.
I haven't read it,
okay.
But do you see parallels? Like
it's a different Odyssey.
Odyssey.
There are way more parallels between the Odyssey in 2000 and other Odyssey adaptations.
Okay.
Like, for example, if you see My Brother, Where Art Thou?
Which I did not understand.
You didn't understand?
At all.
Okay, if you watch that knowing the Odyssey, a lot of things make a lot more sense and things like that.
Okay.
So one of those, if you want a modern adaptation of the Odyssey, I would go for A Brother, Where Art Thou? And there's others as well. There's other things going on. Yeah, there's lots of other Odyssey things as well. Oh, here we go. 3001, The Final Odyssey. Halman uploads itself into a petabyte capacity holographic 3D storage medium and thus survives the disintegration of the monolith, but is infected with the virus and is subsequently sealed by the scientists in the Picoveld. At the close of the story, Poole and other humans land on Europa to start peaceful relations with the primitive native Europeans. So it's one of those things that they...
Sounds fun.
So there's
a bit like Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Well, not sure. Anyway, 3001 follows the adventure of Frank Poole, the astronaut killed by the HAL 9000. Poole's freeze-dried body is discovered in the Kuiper Belt by a comet-collecting space tug. Yeah, so it's pure, like,
more than
science-y
space
kind of thing. Yeah.
That's fun.
Right. Yes, the book, the stuff that I don't, put it this way, here's my book versus movie thing. The stuff that I don't, or that I fast-forward through in the movie, which is
the
apes.
In the book.
Which is the apes and the Stargate sequence.
Is
done way better in the book because it's kind of like it foregrounds the what's going on a lot better than the movie does. And the movie, I just get bored. Whereas that whole middle section, I actually think is better in the movie.
So you kind of need both things
I think it really is one of those things that it's not movie versus the book because there's actually so many things which like are contradictory. You know, like for example, the biggest one, they go to Saturn. And they land on a moon, and they go to Jupiter. But that's sort of like a minor difference. And also, some of the stuff in the book about going out and getting the antenna is a little bit more interesting in that way. Whereas in the movie, it's just much more scary in the movie.
Yeah.
Because you're just sitting there waiting for something to go wrong, and you know it's going to go wrong because, of course, you've seen it four times,
and
five times before. And the music's going on, and it's just the breathing. No, there is no music. It's just the breathing.
It's the breathing and hissing.
Yeah, breathing is like... And just nothing, and you're in space, and it's just
and
like
it's so perfect. I mean, you like in recent movies, there was always like where like when you had like what was it, gravity and stuff. When they have the discussion, okay, in a movie, what would you actually hear of space? Because space
gravity does very well because they do the same thing.
I know, but other movies,
yeah, you hear the explosions like, and there's music and all stuff, that kind of
So I think in this regard,
we should watch Gravity again. It's on Netflix.
Yeah,
I haven't. We saw it once in the cinema.
Yes.
We watched it IMAX in the cinema, didn't we? I think on the big screen.
Yeah, that was the accidental IMAX.
No, that was The Hobbit. We watched The Hobbit accidentally. That one we wanted to watch it on the big 3D screen.
True.
I think so. That one.
Yeah.
So that one we did it. So I kind of want to see how it holds up
as a 2D movie.
As a 2D movie on a LCD screen rather than a 3D screen.
Recently, we do kind of the opposite way around. We
what's that?
Always just watch the movie in 2D.
If someone said, hey, do you want to see Gravity again in 3D at the cinema, instead, if you're going to watch Gravity again at the cinema, 3D or 2D, I'd go 3D again, because that was a really good 3D experience.
And it was filmed in 3D with the intention of 3D, but many movies are just...
Yeah, so we skip the 3D-ness of it.
Yeah.
What else was I going to say?
Are there big parts that like, okay, now you mentioned like two main things that are different in the book. Are there things that missing, like... crucial points missing into the movie?
I think everything that is in the book which isn't in the movie is purely a special effects thing. Like, if Stanley Kubrick wanted to put on screen actually what he wanted to, he would have been able to later on, like with more modern technology. But you would like...
It's more like the restriction.
It's more like that restriction tightened up some of the story. Like, for example, in the book, they do a swing by past Jupiter, and then they approach the planet of Saturn, and everything happens on the way to Saturn, and then they take one of the pods, and the pods, because the gravity on the moon, Iapetus, is so low that he can land with with one of the pods and take off again, and he goes exploring with the pod and all that kind of stuff. Whereas here, in this book, you're just sort of like, here's a black monolith, let's just, instead of him having to go down to a planet, let's just float it in space.
Yeah.
And he just flies up towards it, and it kind of disappears, and then you turn around, and you don't really see...
You don't really see it.
Yeah.
He just appears at this place.
And then he's appearing in the place, whereas in the book, a lot more of that's explained. Like, for example, at the end, he's in a hotel room, and you're like, why is he in that hotel room?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on there? And in the book, it's explained that, like, while the monolith was exposed to the air and picking up radio signals from Earth, it picked up television signals. And so
I totally thought this was just a projection of something that this entity encountered.
Yes.
Because it felt so made up.
It was a TV program. It was a TV show which had a hotel room, and then he goes into the hotel room, but it's at the hotel room is recreated at the resolution of the television at the time.
Yeah.
So where there's books on the wall, and he goes up and tries to read the titles of the book.
But they're too pixelated.
They're just blurred. It's sort of like, oh, it's an impression of this, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what he goes into, and it kind of explains a bit more about how his mind goes forward and then forward again and then forward, and then he becomes a star child. Whereas in the movie, you get this really, I really enjoyed that section where he looks around and he sees himself outwards, and you hear breathing stop there, and then you're like, oh, now he's over there, and then he turns and looks at something else,
and then it's
all about the breathing, because we've been conditioned with the breathing all within the music, and then we hear breaths coming from somewhere else, and then you're like, oh, where his breath is, that's where he is now.
Like, soul is.
Yeah, that's
like
where his soul is. His
consciousness.
And then he looks around, and his previous self has disappeared, and that's it's accelerating through his intellect and age, and then he's reborn as the star child again. It's all that sequence is explained a lot more in the book.
I can imagine that, because watching this, like, I was confused. It did sort of make sense at some point, but the star child was just pathetic to me.
What?
Like this massive big baby with his big eyes, creepy like hell.
Yeah, but it's you can still recognize the actor play who's David Bowie.
That actually is true.
The eyes of the baby, you're like, oh shit, that's him.
Yes,
that's him.
That's actually true. But that was the only thing that I thought, that is the same. That is meant to be the same person. Otherwise, it was just okay. Now this giant baby is floating over the earth.
Again, in the book, it's explained a bit more. If you want the viewing experience to be explained to you, like if you want the author's intention, to be explained
read
to you,
the book.
The book is there.
Okay.
Again, it's a weird thing. Like I say, as he goes up and just before he turns into the Star Child, if I'm reading in the book, then I'll flip back and watch that last sequence, you know, in the hotel room. Yeah, I'll definitely watch that bit. But I'm just saying that the whole him going through the Stargate in the book, that's actually really interesting.
Okay.
Whereas in the movie, it's just a screensaver.
I wish there would be more of this kind of things that you have the collaboration between the movie maker and an author, and then you have a movie and then something be more
here's the thing
detailed.
Then what becomes canon?
Yeah, that's it. I mean,
often what is the final version of the story? There is no final version.
Solaris, we know that the book is the basis.
However, I still think the best the best adaptation of that is the BBC 2-hour dramatization of Solaris.
Have you seen that?
No, I listened to it.
Oh, you listened to
We watched two different movies, and then I listened to the. I think we listened to the dramatization together. We did it on a car journey. We listened to the Solaris, and there's a few things which are in everyone. There's one line when they're talking about something which is in all of the adaptations, and other things are changed. And there are a few things in this which are you know very similar. You know.
Yeah.
Even if it's sort of like, I'm sorry, I can't do that, Dave. You know, he's like, oh.
I love the way they...
Oh, the voice is
the
great.
The voices are so great.
Oh, that's the thing. The voice of Hal, way more creepy. Hal is way more creepy.
In the movie,
because it feels like a malicious force.
Yeah,
in
but
the
he
book,
doesn't
it feels
talk like
that. It feel in the no, but that's why it feels so.
Yes.
But in the movie, in the book, it's sort of defective hardware, and in the movie, and I think that's why in the movie I always think that his intellect has been accelerated and he's become.
It always feels like he's talking to his humans.
Yeah.
As if he's talking to children.
Yes.
In the same kind of. Okay,
yeah, looking
Dave.
Down at them. Yeah, it's like they're his bush babies.
Now.
That's they're his bush babies. If bush babies are going to be a bigger part of the movie, that's what the symbolism is.
Yeah,
like the child getting the bush baby is Hal
like,
getting
when
the humans.
Like when Dave is like, open the pod bay doors. I can't do this.
Yes,
Dave.
I'm sorry. I'm not. I won't do that. Yeah. Anyway, so what was I just about to say? There's a differences between them. What is the correct thing? So Jurassic Park. Directed by Steven Spielberg, based on a book by Michael Crichton. And you're like, well, what was Michael Crichton happy with what Spielberg did with his story?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, because he also wrote the screenplay. So you've got one, you got the author, someone says we want to make a movie, and he's like, it's okay, I've already got the movie in my head. Mm. When he wrote the follow-up novel to Jurassic Park,
The
Lost World, which is like the next novel in the series, it's a follow-up to
the movie. Yes.
Like, what happens in the movie is canonical, and what happens in the book isn't.
It changes.
Yeah, for
so
example, Hammond,
the book,
Hammond
then...
in the book dies at the end of Jurassic Park, the book, but he survives at the end, you know, they fly off in the helicopter together at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
In the second book, he's still alive, you know.
Right.
And all that
so
kind
it changes.
Of thing.
The book was there first,
no, but
then
I'm
the
saying,
movie,
it's
and then,
the same
and
guy.
Then the...
It, what I'm and... saying is with Jurassic Park, Michael Crichton wrote the screenplay
and
he wrote the book, so it feels like he has the right to, when he
change
writes
stuff.
He has the right to, when he... writes the second book, he can retcon it into it. Now, with Arthur C. Clarke, he released the book, but then 2010, Odyssey 2, is a follow-up to the movie. Like, when they go out again,
they go
to Jupiter, they don't go to Saturn.
Oh, right.
And there's some lines in the second movie which are in the first book, you know, so it's a bit hazy about, like, what is it? So when you say, it's a great collaboration, like, if I was to write make a movie and a novel, I would want them to be compatible, you know? But these books and movies aren't internally, like, jointly compatible, but they fill in each other's enough but you know, they fill in bits and pieces between each other. Like the style, which is missing from the book, which he's trying to do with his writing and character work, isn't there. But in the eyes of the actors, so much more is there. Whereas a lot of the details about different technology isn't in the movie foregrounded, but it is in the book. And all the stuff with the Moonwatcher at the start, the Man Apes, is just way better in the book because it's sort of like much more basic storytelling.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to have like, oh, so we're going to go for no spoken word storytelling in like the first 20 minutes, no dialogue of the movie. And then like the last half hour is no dialogue,
yes,
you know.
That's true.
And if you think about it, up until that last exchange between Hal and he's sort of like, yes, I'd like you to sing me that song.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the last thing. And then we have the song.
And the rest is silent.
Well, no, we have the little video bit. But I'm saying we don't have any of two characters talking to it. Like,
no, there's no conversation.
There's audio and vocal audio, but there's no dialogue. There's no exchanging of information between two people with words.
Like at the beginning.
At the beginning, there's no words. And at the end, there's no words. It's like a cycle that goes round. You know?
I think that both of them are really clever.
What's that?
Book and movie. Like, I don't know. I haven't read the book, of course, but from your telling, I think.
Oh, I think you'd actually enjoy the book. Like, I wouldn't say read it now, but like in a year's time, you're thinking about 2001. Just read the book. Like, put it in your library queue when it comes up. It's a short book. It was like, you know, it's like 200 pages or something like that.
Okay,
actually, let me check it out here. I got the audiobook. I listened to the audiobook version.
That's
what is it like? Yeah, 6 hours, 42 minutes. You know, you can get through a book like that in just a few days.
Yeah.
Narrated by Dick Hill, which I'm sure I've listened to other audiobooks narrated by Dick Hill. Always good. Yeah. he's narrated 323 books.
You will have listened to some of those.
I'm sure there's books in my library that I've listened to by Dick Hill. He looks like lots of Jack Reacher novels, and I think there's probably about 300 of them. So, lots of Lee Child's books. So maybe I just recognise the name, but I'm sure I've heard Dick Hill before. A good audiobook. Oh, also another thing about the audiobook is they do a little bit of different stuff. So when he's talking through a radio, they put a radio effect on his mouth. So it's like sort of like. Yes, I'm going to talk to you. And then comes back on. And so there's a little bit of audio stuff, which I never really like in the audio. But because it's 2001, you know, I'll give him a pass.
I'll give him a pass for it. Yeah.
So overall, the movie, enjoyable, enjoyness-wise, if I don't have my own finger on the fast-forward button, I don't enjoy the movie very much. But if I can fast-forward through stuff...
Yeah, there's like, would you say like 20 minutes to... 20 minutes of stuff that's expendable, expendable...
I would say if I was to do a fan edit of 2001, there's quite a bit of the stuff going to the moon part there, which I think it's good and I enjoy it.
You mean him seeing him sleeping on?
No, I love all the human moments
this
of going
is so
to the
great.
The human moments going to the moon are so great.
Yeah.
But there's that one shot where the spaceship's already landed and it's just a platform being lowered down into the moon.
That is-
And I'm just seeing it. I'm like, this is 45 seconds long.
Yeah.
And I like it, but it's sort of like, what part of the story is this progressing? What new information are we seeing here? And there's just a few shots like that. Not many, but there's a few shots throughout the middle section, which I would tighten up a bit.
Yes.
But yeah, I would cut, I reckon, the opening, 5 minutes of apes. You don't need 19 minutes of apes. You need 5 minutes of apes at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then the Stargate stuff. I would cut that down to... I would cut out... Like, I would put in some of the screenshot stuff.
Yes.
But then there's these helicopter shots of flying over landscapes.
Yeah.
All of that gone.
Yeah.
All of that gone.
Yeah.
Definitely all of that gone.
The eye
and then just blink the eye.
Yeah.
And then because he's gone through a stargate and at the other end, he's just flying across, like, you know... Kansas or Nevada is just flying across the desert, like really recognizable Earth landscapes.
Yeah.
And at that point in the movie, I don't want really recognizable Earth landscapes.
Yeah, you want something totally different. Or you don't want to see anything.
I don't want to see anything.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind at that point. You know, at some points I would cut out the intermission and some of the transitions I would just finesse slightly.
Yeah, some of the transitions were quite
I like some of them. I like some of the transitions, but some of them were just sort of like, and now title card. And you're just like, I probably wouldn't need the title card. Some of them.
What's a title card?
When it comes up, Chapter 4, To Infinity and Beyond.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those
oh,
right. kind of things
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
I don't
well,
always...
Well, that's very much like theatre style.
Yes.
And that's definitely something coming out from that time when they made the movie.
Yeah.
Definitely.
At Jupiter, Bowman leaves us... Because you don't need to say, oh, Jupiter and Beyond Infinities or whatever
yeah.
like that.
It's clear where we are now.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
He leaves Discovery 1 in an EVA pod to investigate another monolith orbiting the planet. The pod is pulled into a vortex of coloured light, the Stargate, and Bowman races across vast distances of his space, viewing bizarre cosmological phenomena and strange landscapes of unusual colours. That way it says there, strange landscapes of unusual colours.
That was not a strange landscape.
It's, they're not
it
strange
was a normal landscape
Earth,
in colours.
Earth landscapes with different colour
yeah.
filters. Well, not filters. They're only doing like one of the three colour
yes.
whatever things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like that.
Yeah, I know.
And then the end, yeah. I'd pretty much leave that whole end sequence in place.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a tricky one. But yeah, it's never going to be a 5-star movie for me because for me, I always rate star ratings are always... how much I personally enjoy something.
Yeah.
And if I think I can improve a movie by doing some basic cutting, it's not a 5-star movie.
It definitely isn't. And also, I think if there's a movie and I only remember like a third of the movie, really,
mm-hmm.
after a few years, well, the rest was kind of lost on me.
Yeah. And I know that's true as well. And I think that's the reason why whenever you say 2001 A Space Odyssey, everybody goes to open the pod bay doors, Hal. And I'm sorry, I can't do that, Dave.
Daisy.
That
is only like a tiniest moment.
Yes, it's the tiniest moment.
I somehow thought he was singing this during the trip.
No.
He wasn't.
No.
It was just in my head that he was like while they were doing
he's
their
regressing,
stuff.
He's regressing down to a child
so
again,
crazy.
You know.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and I really enjoy, some of the most boring stuff in the movie is some of the stuff that I enjoy the most when it's sort of like, oh, I've got a birthday message from my parents
yes.
and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, I could just watch it because it's that documentary style
yeah.
is what I like about it.
Yeah, totally.
And then the drama, like, you know, horror elements
mm.
I like about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the kind of experimental, oh, we've got some special picture effects here.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's not really my kind of thing.
Yeah.
Although I did notice... some watching on the Blu-ray version, some of the special effects look way better, but then some of them look you can kind of see the drawings
yeah.
a little bit better.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, you know, some mostly a blessing, but also
yeah.
a little bit of a curse.
Where they have Frank flying through space, and then you can suddenly see like a transition, and he's like,
yeah, a little bit. So, but also, I'm just saying, like, when at the start, when I went over to fast forward a bit through it,
yeah.
and I was like, hey, look, you can
the
actually
backdrop.
See the backdrop behind the apes. You can see that it's a back projection. You can see kind of like this, the treatment of the back projection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's some of those kind of things. Like, again, I wouldn't ever fix anything. I wouldn't George Lucas it up and change
yeah.
the special effects.
Yeah.
But I think some of it could be tightened up to make it like the start and the end paced a little bit more like a modern movie to get
yeah.
you into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I still think it holds up really well.
Yeah.
In terms of
there's one
can
other thing.
We watch it and not like.
There's one other thing that I would do
flinch.
If I could find some lost footage is when they're at the monolith on
yeah.
the moon
yeah.
and they're taking photos and they all come together with the photo and suddenly it goes and they
yeah.
all like hold onto their helmets and
yes.
stuff like that and
yeah.
then it just cuts.
Yeah.
I want 10 seconds more of them reacting.
Yeah.
I know that's such a crazy thing, but that's
yeah.
the transition that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I want 10 seconds more of them like reacting to the monolith,
yeah.
maybe turning to the monolith,
yeah.
one person looking at it, and then cut. Because
It didn't, like, for me as well, it didn't quite feel
yeah.
natural to what happened.
No.
Like, they just hold their ears, and
yeah.
then we are...
And then we're in on the way to Jupiter.
Yeah.
And again, all I wish for is, like... 10 seconds extra there
yeah.
and then shorter apes,
yeah.
shorter Stargate
yeah.
and everything else could be the same
yeah.
and then it would be a perfect movie for me.
Yeah.
But I can't sit through 18 and a half minutes of apes,
yeah.
of the ape men. It just, I can't do it anymore,
yeah.
which is a real pity because
so
it's the start of the movie.
How would you then still rate it? Like in the way that we watch it now?
The way that we watch it, when I had my finger on the fast forward button.
Yeah, well...
But no, I really enjoyed sitting here talking to you because we've both seen it before and we both knew that we would discuss it, so we could actually bring up different topics. Like, yes. I was like, oh, this is the thing here. Oh, look at that bit there. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. I don't mind sharing my 2001 trivia and mentioning a few little things between the book and the movie, like, as we're watching it. So I totally... Blu-ray version with my finger on the fast forward button. It's a really, really fun movie watching experience.
Totally is.
But...
And it's impressive how your brain just tricks you. Your memory is just...
Yeah, that's it.
Your memory is coming up with things that weren't even in the movie.
Yeah. Remind me after this. I want to show you the Lego version of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
What?
Yeah, it's like a minute long. 30 seconds long. And it retells 2001 A Space Odyssey with Lego.
Okay.
And then, of course, the book itself. I think the book is a solid 3-star book. It's fine. If this was the book and there was no movie about it... I'm not sure it would be a classic book. I mean, there's nothing in the book which makes it a classic science fiction story beyond any other Arthur C. Clarke or any other book from 1969 or 1968 or whenever the book came out.
Yeah.
It's a perfectly fine book. Arthur C. Clarke writing about technology and a few other bits and pieces. that's it. 3 stars, averaging them out. You know, 2001... collecting between the book versus the music, or book additional to movie and music and soundtrack. And like I said, I have the 2001 Space Odyssey soundtrack here on in my iTunes. So it's not as if it's like I've not listened to this a few times.
It's an iconic collection. Check
this out at the end.
Three of the five men were put aboard asleep, or to be more.
Let me put it this way, Mr. Raymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer.
It's a collection of all of Hal's dialogue in the movie there.
Cool.
It's an extra track
at
the end.
It's so soothing in a way.
We get Jupiter. Maybe I should check. I'd love to actually see if someone does an edit where it's the original soundtrack that was written for the movie. I think I'd kind of like to see that one as well.
Who wrote this music then?
Let me have a quick look here. Music. From very early on in the production, Kubrick decided that he wanted the film to be a primarily non-verbal experience. Okay, so Alex North, he commissioned a score. He'd also written the score for Spartacus and worked on Dr. Strangelove. During post-production, Kubrick chose to abandon North's music in favour of the now familiar classical pieces he had earlier chosen as temporary music for the film. North did not learn that the score had been abandoned until he saw the film's premiere.
No way!
But it says here, there's been two different releases, like the original mono recording, and then Jerry Goldsmith worked with the National Philharmonic Orchestra and made another recording of that.
Right.
So what I'd love to see is like the movie recut to that music, or that music put into what it is there.
Do we have recordings of the North soundtrack?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's two different ones. There's the original soundtrack that he recorded, which was a mono soundtrack, and then, as I said, Jerry Goldsmith also recorded, got together the National Philharmonic Orchestra and did another recording of that. Of the North soundtrack, which is available on CD or something like that.
Cool.
So overall, a fun experience, a fun watching experience, and a fun reading experience. You should read, like I say, give it a bit, and then read the book until you've forgotten a few more things about the movie, so you're not constantly comparing. Because it's been like 3 or 4 years since I last saw 2001.
Yes.
So then reading the book, I kind of could experience the book as a fresh thing in my mind.
Yeah.
And then I don't mind then watching the movie with the book fresh in my mind.
Yeah. The visual input is always stronger.
Yeah, the characters are just so much stronger. Like I say, how much David Bowman doesn't react with his eyes those first interactions with him and Hal is so great.
Yeah.
Is so great.
Yeah.
And it comes down to that chess game. In the movie, the chess game is so great. And Hal is like, this, 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 and this. And then he's like, it looks like you're right, Hal. You know, it looks like you got me that time, Hal, is what he's saying there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just knows that if he needs to do something next time, like when he goes out and he's sort of like, it looks like you got me, Hal. Like, his eyes are saying that again.
Well, that's Frank.
What? Was it Frank who
it's
was doing...
Frank.
Oh, that was Frank on the chess game.
Yeah.
Okay, either way. But in the book, it's explained, oh, HAL was programmed to make it so that the humans won 50% of each one of their chess games. You know? So it felt like they could always do it. So in the book, it's a bit more like HAL is, you know, already okay with, like, playing games with them in that way. So, like, there's the difference between it. But, okay, so it wasn't David who was losing the chess game, but you can see that he's lost chess to HAL many times in the past as well.
Well, he knows him
pretty well.
I also like showing the pictures and stuff.
What's that? Like, oh yeah, can you look at that picture for me, like there? And you're like, oh, there's a humanity gap between these two as well. All right, I think that's it. We've talked about the movie and the book versus movie for about an hour. Yeah. Did you enjoy the podcast discussion as well?
I did.
I'm sure.
I learned stuff about the book that I did not know before.
And also about the movie that you maybe did not know before. And also some of Luke's own headcanon about HAL being influenced by the monolith. Which is, again, it's explicitly not in the book and also not in the movie. Explicit, like, very much just Luke's reading of that. So I know as soon as we press stop and we start that day again, we're going to get some lunch and we're going to continue talking about this movie again, because that's kind of the kind of thing it is. All right, so that's it. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. You can also follow me on Goodreads. Become my friend on Goodreads. And I, too, I can see what you think about these books here. Raydon Zen rated it 5 stars. John Crawshaw 2 stars. Brian rated it 3 stars. So yes, lots of people have rated this book an average rating of 3.95.
That's about right.
That's between SFBRP listeners and general on Science Fiction Book Review Podcast, 4.13. I do not think that it's that good of a book.
No.
But people are bringing with it there...
The movie. Yes.
And as I say, it builds up...
Between
its,
the two of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, it builds up its weight as a book and the enjoyment of the book because it brings along the visuals of the movie. And again, that doesn't happen very often.
No.
Either the visuals, what's in the book and what's in the movie, clash.
Yeah.
And people who like the movie are like... Well, it's not as good. Oh, it's people. Yeah, like, it's not as good as the book, or oh, you know, the movie. Oh, the book's too long and boring, but the movie is good. You know, so I kind of, and also when I was reading the book, I was still picturing some of those shots.
Are so iconic in your head.
Yeah,
it's difficult to get rid of them, I think.
Yeah.
All right.
So. Bits and pieces. Some people, lots and lots of my friends have read it and rated it there as well. Also, you can become my friend on letterboxd.com and you can see what movies I'm watching.
you imported all the movies.
It turns out, Letterboxd, I already had text documents of all the movies that I'd watched, so all I had to do was format it as a, CSV, comma separated value file.
Yeah.
And it was already listed there as well. And I could just put it in and it goes, oh, we couldn't find this movie. And I'm like, look, it's got 2001 A Space Odyssey, but because I hadn't put the colon in the right place or something like that, it was like, we don't recognize this. And I was like, yes, you do. It's 2001 A Space.
Yes.
So I could upload my ratings and...
Since when?
And tags. Going back to the beginning of 2003.
Immediately
on Letterboxd, I think I've got 5 years worth of movie watching.
Not bad.
5.5 years of movie watching since I've been tracking which movies I've watched and how I enjoyed them or not.
Well done.
And if they lived up to expectations. So there's another thing, if you're interested in movie watching. Don't know what next movie I'm going to watch was. I put some things... Things when we're at home, we often watch Netflix TV shows, so we're watching those kind of things.
Or we go to the cinema if a new movie comes out.
A movie comes out, yeah. So we will get to some other movies. Maybe we'll watch Gravity again. Or maybe we'll do another the book versus the movie. I'm not sure.
Gravity?
No, not with Gravity.
Just in general.
I'm just saying in general. If anyone's got a suggestion of a book and movie, which is a combination, either the book comes from the movie or the movie comes from the book.
Yeah.
I guess we did that a bit.
Like Stephen King is kind of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's lots of Stephen King stuff,
right?
But not a lot of science fiction.
No.
And I want to kind of keep it more science fiction.
Of course.
Anyway, so that's it. Yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. Oh, also become Juliana's friend on goodreads.com.
Yeah.
And if you want me to read a book, drop it there in the suggestions. Books I would like to see reviewed thread on the SFBRP listener group. And I think that's what we always normally say at the end of this podcast. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.